million properties at risk today, and 13.6 million at risk of flooding in 2051. 2 million miles of road are at risk today, and that is expected to increase to 2.2 million miles of road over the next 30 years. Commercial properties are expected to see a 7% increase in risk of flooding from 2021 to 2051, with 918,540 at risk today and 984,051 at risk of flooding in 30 years. Currently, 35,776 critical infrastructure facilities are at risk today, increasing to 37,786 facilities by 2051, a 6% increase in risk. And compounding that risk, 71,717 pieces of social infrastructure facilities are at risk today, increasing to 77,843 by 2051, an increase of 9% over that time period. The report comes in the wake of several highly destructive flooding events that affected various parts of the U.S. this summer, including one in Tennessee in August, as well as the inundation of New York City's subway system in July and again in September during Hurricane Ida. Deadly and costly disasters that exposed how ill-prepared the U.S. is to reduce extreme weather-related infrastructure damage and the ensuing consequences. The new analysis also points to earlier catastrophes such as Hurricane Sandy, which hit the New York City metropolitan area in 2012 and flooded hospitals, crippled electrical substations, overwhelmed wastewater treatment centers, and shut down power and water to tens of millions of people. The U.S. infrastructure is not built to a standard that protects against the level of flood risk Americans face today, let alone how those risks will grow over the next 30 years as the climate changes, Matthew Ebby, founder and executive director of the First Street Foundation, said in a statement, adding, "This report highlights the cities and counties whose vital infrastructure are most at risk today and will help inform where investment dollars should flow in order to best mitigate against that risk." According to the report, there are significant differences at the county and city level in amount of risk that exists today and into the future. Most importantly, there are a group of counties and cities that have persistent patterns of vulnerability across multiple dimensions of physical risk from flooding. These areas tend to be in regions with well-established flood risk, such as coastal floodplains along the Gulf and southeastern coast of the U.S., but also in less well-known flood zones, such as in Appalachian mountain regions of West Virginia and Kentucky. To that point, 17 of the top 20 counties in the U.S. which are most at risk, that is about 85%, are in the states of Louisiana, Florida, West Virginia, and Kentucky. Additionally, the top cities at risk of flooding persistently show up in the states of Louisiana, Florida, Texas, and South Carolina. The analysis further uncovered a high degree of vulnerability in some of the major population centers in the U.S., including New Orleans, Miami, Tampa, Charleston, Chicago, and Los Angeles.
Thank you. Sometimes someone's name is exactly what it should be, like Ruhullah or God's soul. Many people ask, did he know what he brought to the country as a souvenir? But his lovers remind them that he was Ruhullah. During the several years after he came down the airplane stairs, he was here to finish what was left unfinished for the past 70 or more years. He said there would come a day when children in cradles will accompany him. And when they attacked Khomeini's Iran from air, land, sea, with everything they had, it was the children in the cradle's turn who had now become strong young men to stand up with names that were like themselves or even their family names, like Hossein, like Badpa, meaning as swift as the wind.
In memory of Hossein Badpa.
When someone talks about a martyr, it is not strange to hear familiar descriptions. They might sometimes even sound cliché. For example, imagine that you want to talk about courage, kindness, faith, and good manners of a martyr, as they all had these characteristics. They were some people who were like each other even in their names. Mahdi, Muhammad, Ali, Hassan, Hussein, Ibrahim, and Qasim. What difference does it make what their names and their birth certificate is, or where they are from? If you can show a martyr who can easily be found among all other martyrs, it means he had something that would make him stand out. It's something hard to do. Here, social, family, or occupational status will not work on its own. You have to look for something else. War is not easy, especially in a battlefield like the 8-year defense. Putting aside the hardships during the war, there are risks as well. Being wounded, captured, or killed. But despite all this, there are things in the battlefield that not many people can do. It means there are some people among the fighters who choose to do the harder things, like the guys in the Operation Intelligence Unit. But there were many times that the fighters would have to remain in the enemy's territory to get the necessary information from the enemy's roads, forces, and facilities. So, undoubtedly, you can say that if Hossein Badpa is supposed to be in the war, he has to remain in the Operation Intelligence Unit. But in the Operation Intelligence Unit of the Sarallah 41st Division, there are still lots of tough things that not everyone can do. And it means, if what we know about Badpa is true, he has to shoulder doing this tough task as well. But what's the toughest thing to do? Giving up your life in the path of God? This was what all fighters wished for. Getting wounded? That's also sweet. What is more honorable than having a mark on your body until hereafter that makes you keep your head high up among those who stand up for our religion? It's obvious that getting separated from the comrades who have been martyred is hard. But you can pin your hopes on this verse from the Holy Quran. Among the believers, there are those who have remained true to their covenant they made with Allah. Then what? What is the hardest thing to do that the hero in our story has to shoulder? That's it. You won't become a martyr. For someone like Hossein, it was a huge disappointment. Just think about it. Your injuries from the war affect 70% of your body, and you ask yourself all the time if you deserve to be martyred or not. And it's only about you. Someone among the people, most of whom have reached a destination and the rest have not lost hope, that they will become martyrs. Yet, this is the hardest thing to do. Finding yourself in the raucous world, especially when your comrades are not with you, is the hardest thing to do. That's exactly what the guys in the Operation Intelligence Unit do, all alone among the enemy forces. That's why, when the war ended and after he accomplished his mission in the IRGC, he decided to start anew. Maybe he thought he had come the wrong way. Or maybe, by creating jobs and helping people put food on the table, he was on a soul-searching mission. Time is like the wind that blows. It both exists and does not. When it exists, the memories and experiences are also there, but when it does not, it means that you've spent your life. But if all of these lead to the right decision, why would you worry that your hair is becoming gray? It's the choice everyone can make only once in their lives, the hard time of going or staying. Like Ashura, like choosing those whose beard had grown gray for the plain of Karbala, like Habib. The passion to defend the shrine of Ahl al-Bayt is not something new for Shias. They are born to die for Ali and his children. They are alive to only shout out loud that they love Imam Hussein, so they draw the attention of the people all across the world to Karbala. After Syria became like this, the passion to defend the shrine of Ahl al-Bayt grew in many people's hearts. But those who were from Kerman were a different story. Now, the standard bearer of defending the holy shrine in the world of Islam was their former commander. That was why their honor wouldn't allow them to leave him alone in the new battlefield. For example, someone like Haj Hussein. Qasem Soleimani was not only a commander for him. What could he do? He knew that Haj Qasem loved him, but he was strict about deploying veterans to the new battlefield. But he was worried that Haj Qasem might still remember what martyr Qasemi had said. You won't become a martyr. He always felt the weight of these words. They had come down on Haj Hussein like a ton of bricks, and no one showed up to rescue him. When the martyrs of the defense of the holy shrine came back to Iran one by one, Hussein felt the agony again. But when Muhammad Jamali got martyred, he could not bear it. He insisted, but General Soleimani did not agree. He came up with a plan. He took his wife to Haj Qasem. He asked her to intervene. He was right. No matter how determined Qasem Soleimani as a commander was, when it comes to a faithful woman, he gives it a second thought. You know, for Shias, Chador is a different story. That was how Hossein Badpa managed to go to Syria. But later on, when he got disappointed again that he did not get martyred, again it was General Soleimani who told him a secret. So Hussein stayed and embraced what he was looking for. War in Syria takes its own men. Being courageous and experienced is not enough. If you want to be even an ordinary sniper, you need to be someone special, let alone being a commander. Despite all this, Hossein Badpa was a person who easily stood out in Syria, much easier than in our own battlefields. Hossein shone among the defenders of the shrine and was special for everyone in a different way. But Hussein himself was still reeling under those old words. What could he do? He went to Haj Qasem. Haj Qasem suggested that he implore Martyr Qazami's mother. She's a mother after all. If she prays, Muhammad Reza Qazami will intercede and he will be rescued from the weight of that prediction. It was the better guidance. He knew Martyr Qazami's family from a long time ago, but now things were different. He did not know if Muhammad Reza's mother will agree to do what he wanted. He felt confident about Muhammad Reza's mother. But that day, when Mustafa Sadrzadeh was in front of our camera, he did not know that his turn for the glorious moment of martyrdom will arrive soon. What he talked about might be the same peace Hossein Bhatpa was looking for, the strange feeling of doubt about whether he'll be accepted or not. Hossein Bhatpa, a war veteran whose injuries affected 70% of his body. He was martyred in Dar'a on April the 20th, 2015. After Hossein Bhatpa got martyred, his body was not retrieved. He said he knew that Haj Qasem would put the veterans' bodies in their graves, so he did not want General Soleimani to be filled with sadness in his burial. That's why all of the bodies returned, except for his. The only thing was that his family missed him. His wife, Muhammad, Fatime, and his youngest son, Ehsan, who was impatient to see his father. Maybe what he promised his wife made them feel calm. He said, "After I die, you'll get to meet the leader."
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders has recently unveiled a new report estimating that the United States is hoarding nearly 500 million excess coronavirus vaccine doses, the most of any country, as poor nations across the globe remain without sufficient access to life-saving shots. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Reckless, Doctors Without Borders slams U.S. for hoarding 500 million vaccine doses. Stay tuned for more. The humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders unveiled a new report recently estimating that the United States of America is hoarding nearly 500 million excess coronavirus vaccine doses, most of any country, as poor nations across the globe remain without sufficient access to life-saving shots. It's reckless and dangerous for the U.S. and other high-income countries to be sitting on excessive stocks of COVID-19 vaccines while others are desperate to provide their most vulnerable people with even their first dose. Dr. Carrie Teicher, Director of Programs at Doctors Without Borders USA, said in a statement, arguing that the Biden administration's hoarding of doses calls into question its claim to be a global leader on COVID-19. The longer people everywhere remain unprotected, the more lives will be lost, and the more likely it is that new and potentially deadlier variants will take hold, said Teicher. The U.S. must immediately make public and concrete commitments to redistribute excess COVID-19 vaccines globally if it truly wants to end this pandemic. To date, the Biden administration has pledged to donate roughly 1.1 billion surplus coronavirus vaccine doses to low-income countries, a commitment that public health campaigners have criticized as badly inadequate to meet global needs. According to the State Department, the U.S. has shipped around 177 million vaccine donations thus far. The World Health Organization has estimated that in order to vaccinate at least 70% of the global population by next year, 11 billion doses equitably distributed will be necessary. Doctors Without Borders, known internationally as Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, said recently that even while factoring in third-dose boosters for high-risk groups, high-income countries are hoarding an estimated 870 million excess doses, including nearly 500 million in the U.S. alone. The rapid redistribution of these doses to low- and middle-income countries could save nearly 1 million lives by mid-2022, the group said. In addition to immediately redistributing vaccine doses globally and demanding vaccine technology, the U.S. must remain committed and urge all countries to support the TRIPS waiver proposal at the World Trade Organization to waive intellectual property monopolies on all COVID-19 products during the pandemic. Public Citizen President Robert Weizmann noted in a statement that all African countries combined have had roughly 150 million doses administered. Africa has a population of over 1.34 billion. The U.S. population is 330 million, Weizmann said. But put it simply, Africa has four times the population of the U.S., but has administered about one-third the number of COVID vaccine doses. This unconscionable vaccine apartheid is not just leaving billions of people in African and other developing countries vulnerable to preventable disease, suffering, and death. It is dramatically increasing global poverty rates, as well as the death, disease, and hunger that accompany severe poverty. In its report recently, Doctors Without Borders warned that millions of doses could be tragically wasted if HICs, or high-income countries, do not immediately redistribute excess doses. G7 and EU countries alone could waste 241 million doses by the end of 2021, the group estimated, adding, still, pharmaceutical companies continue to prioritize high-profit sales to HICs over a fairer distribution of vaccines. Teicher of Doctors Without Borders said recently that the COVID-19 vaccine inequity that pharma has created by putting profits before people's health is nothing short of shameful. In addition to developing a concrete dose redistribution timeline, by the end of October, the U.S. government must demand vaccine companies to share their technology and know-how. Teicher added, sharing these technologies will increase the global production and supply of COVID-19 vaccines, saving lives in this pandemic and in the future. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing the Netflix documentary Get Me Roger Stone, directed by Dylan Bank, Daniel DeMauro, and Morgan Penny. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Zach Cochran, who is an anti-racist activist with the campaign group Stand Up to Racism. Now, Get Me Roger Stone explores the life and career of the American political strategist Roger Stone, who is known as the dark mastermind behind Donald Trump's presidential campaign and is arguably responsible for putting him in the White House. Stone is a self-proclaimed dirty trickster, and this documentary exposes Stone as a man who knows no bounds when it comes to winning in politics.
He loves the game, he has fun with it, and he's very good at it.
I'm an agent provocateur.
Political strategist,
controversial as you can get.
An incredible capacity for treachery.
Win-at-all-cost mentality.
When people think of Washington corruption, they think of Roger Stone.
Those who say I have no soul, those who say I have no principles, are losers. Those are bitter losers.
There's really nobody quite like Roger Stone.
The Nixon tattoo is really all you need to know about Roger.
We really pioneered negative campaign advertising.
He created the modern sleazeball lobbyist.
Washington's been worse for it ever since.
Stone's rule, it is better to be infamous than never be famous at all.
He got chased out of Washington.
He's looking to see if he can find an angle.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
Roger saw something that nobody else saw back in the early 80s.
I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
He created Donald Trump as a political figure.
You're the biggest liar, loser!
What have I lied about?
Have you spoken with the WikiLeaks founder?
You're a rape tonight.
Roger, you can't just say that.
You have to be outrageous to get noticed.
I revel in your hatred, because if I weren't effective, you wouldn't hate me.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Get Me Roger Stone?
Well, the trailer really gets the tone of the film. It's done in this kind of lively, jaunty, comedic tone. But the material is just bone-chilling. It's absolutely horrifying to watch it, especially as it goes back kind of 40 years in the past, 50 years even, to him working with Nixon and Reagan and Bush and, I mean, basically all the kind of slightly shady campaigns that have gone on over the years.
It is surprisingly funny, as you say.
But it's done with this kind of sense of humor, kind of because he's so unapologetic about it. He just doesn't make any bones about it. He talks about using lies and deception in all of his work and how he's very proud of doing that. And it's pretty horrifying. And also the fact that he's been working with Trump since the early 80s, which I didn't know that before, and I'd heard of him. I mean, he's been in the news. But I didn't know that he's been basically grooming Trump to be president since he met him, because he thought, oh, this is quite a quirky character that the people seem to love. Maybe, you know, maybe he'd be a good one. It just gave me the chills.
And what about you, Zach? What was your take on what Get Me Roger Stone, and had you heard of him before?
I'd never heard of Roger Stone, but absolutely very watchable program. For many people, with Trump's election, it sent shocks around the world. So to actually get some insight into how Donald Trump could have been elected, I think was very, very interesting. And to see, as Richard has said, that over four decades now, Roger Stone has not only been grooming guys like Donald Trump, but has been involved in countless campaigns. But also, we hear about the power of US lobbying firms, but to see one of the guys who was instrumental in this kind of sleazeball politics and how he unapologetically promoted that was very, very interesting, yeah.
I think the character you're talking about is Paul Manafort, and we're going to dissect his character a bit later on. But I must say, I think we can all agree that when Donald Trump won the presidency, it took nearly everyone by surprise, and many thought it was merely a publicity stunt. But after watching this documentary, you get a sense that there is, in fact, a method behind all the madness. And did you get that feeling as well, Rich?
Well, yeah, there's definitely this sense that, I mean, Roger Stone claims he's just an agent provocateur. All he wants to do is shake up the system. He doesn't care about helping people, so he doesn't have any of those political values that you would think a political leader should have. He just wants to shake things up. So Trump is his perfect candidate, and you can see how he honed his skills through Nixon and Reagan and Bush, and then it all pays off for him and Trump, which means that we all pay for it. It's a pretty frightening depiction of the way that this thing unfolded over all these years. You kind of think of Trump as being a fairly recent thing because he's only emerged on the scene in the last year or two as a serious candidate, but actually this has been in the works. So.
Years in the making. Yeah.
In 1987, I suggested that Trump should explore a bid for the presidency.
This sounds like political presidential talk to me, and I know people have talked to you about whether or not you want to run. Would you ever?
Probably not, but I do get tired of seeing what's happening with this country, and if it got so bad, I would never want to rule it out totally, because I really am tired of seeing what's happening with this country.
I was like a jockey looking for a horse. You can't win the race if you don't have a horse.
I interceded with the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce to arrange a lunch. The helicopter landing was as big a news as his speech. This is kind of the first time I saw the power of Trump. The public interest in Trump was palpable. It was like electric. And he lit the place on fire.
That comment, I was a jockey looking for a horse. I mean, as despicable of a character Stone is, he is quite funny. You have to give him that at least. And Rich, Stone takes a lot of credit for putting Trump in the White House. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, he basically created Trump as a political figure, and you hear Stone use all the words that Trump uses in his speeches. So you realize that Roger Stone has been feeding him all of these lines, all of these famous lines that we think of Trump as saying, originated in Roger Stone. And the film also kind of documents the whole kind of shady political situation where Stone was part of the campaign, then dropped out of the campaign, but really didn't. That was just a public ruse, and then kind of secretly was still running things. And it's all very dodgy, but Stone is just totally unapologetic about all of it. He just admits the whole thing. He admits that it's a big ruse. It's a trick to trick the voters into voting for someone like this.
He is famous for being infamous.
Yeah.
And Zach, I want to bring you in here because you're with the Stand Up to Racism, and you've organized numerous protests against Donald Trump when he was inaugurated and the Muslim ban. And surely you protest not just Donald Trump as an individual, but people like Roger Stone and what they stand for.
Absolutely. This what was so useful about this film was to get an insight into the kind of politics that were pushing Donald Trump. And I actually want to say this process, what became clear from the film, goes back to Nixon. Actually, Nixon came to power in 1968. There was a book at the time by one of his advisors, Kevin Phillips, that talked about the emerging Republican majority, about channeling the voters' resentment, and that largely played out in turning the economic insecurities of white Americans into resentments towards black. It was a key strategy of Nixon, and we see this through the film. When they talk about racist coding, the language is being used, pushed through a number of candidates, but particularly with Donald Trump, we see the appalling election campaign. He ran the Muslim ban, the scapegoating of Mexicans, saying he would build the wall with Mexico. It's clear that Roger Stone was absolutely instrumental in encouraging Trump to go down this racist rhetoric, which had wider ramifications.
Well, and the whole birther movement, which was Roger Stone created that whole thing about Donald Trump chasing Obama for his birth certificate was a Roger Stone create. That was his little, and that was a racist campaign that was playing into the hands of those right wing people who have those views, who don't feel like they can express them and feel marginalized, and it's all about manipulating the people, isn't it?
So are you saying that Stone is actually as influential as he makes out to be in the world of politics?
I think he's very influential. I'm not convinced that he's actually racist. I think he's manipulating people's opinions and people's, you know, the way people feel. But he is very influential, quite clearly.
Unfortunately so. And Zach, Stone says in the documentary that Stone says that Trump is sort of this anti-establishment figure. And how is it that people perceive him to be this way, and is it accurate?
I think what we absolutely have to say, and it was brought out in the film, Trump was able to fill a vacuum. We've seen, not just in America, but a number of countries, the hollowing out of politics. The establishment, there's been deep dissatisfaction with them, years of neoliberal policies, and Trump was able to come in and channel that anti-establishment sentiment, not by offering people policies, redistribution of wealth, but by encouraging people to draw conclusions like scapegoating the Muslim community and migrant communities as well.
Mm-hmm. And in the documentary, Roger says that, someone who's interviewed says about Roger that he understands democracy and that democracy is appealing to the process of the majority. How accurate is this, and what do you make this claim in the film that Stone understands democracy?
Well, yeah, obviously, because he's appealing to these opinions that are unvoiced, and so he's tapping into the majority of people, the way that they feel, and which is kind of horrifying.
Mm-hmm. And does Trump represent the majority of America?
No, I think absolutely not. If you look at this is the such a worrying thing. His policies. He wants to cut corporation tax to record lows. Roll back on initiatives to tackle climate change, things that do not benefit ordinary Americans. You know, the population, we're the richest country in the world, yet a quarter of the population live in poverty, and this is a billionaire. But it's absolutely by scapegoating, deflecting blame at the establishment. It's a bogus anti-establishment. What we see very clearly from this film, Stone, his close advisor, has been involved with and Manafort, who we're going to come on to.
Actually, I'm glad you brought him up because we're about to go to him just now. So we'll just pause there for now.
Trump asked me to get involved because my reputation, among other things in politics, is understanding of the convention process, the delegate process, and most of the major successful big conventions over the last 30 years I've been intimately involved in.
Did Roger recommend you for the job?
Roger was one of the two or three people who strongly recommended me, yes.
Is it a surprise that Paul Manafort wound up as the campaign chairman for Trump? No, of course not. That was engineered by Roger as a way to get Corey Lewandowski bounced out of the campaign. It took a couple months, but they did it. Roger has had a guiding hand in all of this. Now, Trump is hard to guide. He spits the bit out, but Roger's had as much influence on the campaign as anyone.
I think the campaign's been professionalized. Manafort's doing a phenomenal job. I think he instills confidence in the campaign that they didn't have before.
Did you give any reporters background on Lewandowski?
No.
Okay, so do you sort of...
Roger is not an official part of the campaign.
Did he bring you in?
No.
You were just talking about Paul Manafort and how much of a shady character he is. And considering his relationship with dictators, his role in lobbying, what contribution did he make to Donald Trump's campaign team?
It was clear when Roger Stone was fired, when denies being fired, the fact Manafort suggests that Stone recommended him and was absolutely crucial in using some of those dirty tactics to get Donald Trump elected. It shows just how bogus this idea of Trump being anti-establishment is, because Manafort's been involved with countless presidents over the decades and played the same role.
And Rich, why is it that Paul Manafort, we know that he has a relationship with Roger Stone, but denies him being involved in the campaign? I mean, is this all part of the plan? What is going on here?
I just think it's part of the way that they present one thing to the public and they talk about something. I mean, all through this film, they're talking to the cameras, because the cameras are following these people all over the place. They say one thing to the camera, then it cuts to a statement like that where Paul Manafort's on television saying exactly the opposite. So they very carefully script what they say in public, and it's not, they don't care that it's not the truth. It's all about creating this image that gets them where they want to go, and they don't really care about what they have to do to get there.
And isn't that disturbing, Zach, that these politicians are lying through their teeth? Don't they think that people can see right through this and hold them to account?
They've had many decades of perfecting the strategy. It's interesting that the film starts with Roger Stone talking about as a kid in the school canteen in a mock election where he, at the time, ironically, is back in JFK, and he tells all the other kids that Nixon will make you go to school on Saturday to win this mock election. He said he learned there the value of disinformation, and we've seen this process throughout his political career, and it is very worrying. It makes a mockery of democracy and allows them to distort politics in the interest of those at the top.
Mm. And Rich, we know that Roger Stone is dubbed as the political dirty trickster. What examples do we see in this documentary of his other stunts?
Well, I mean, all of the stuff, all of the crooked Hillary stuff, you know, just suddenly creating this huge cloud of suspicion around the Clintons, around Obama, just everything that kind of, it's just this huge cloud of misinformation that just goes around, and everybody starts to wonder, well, what's the truth? And it's very hard to pick the truth out of it, especially if you're leaning toward that angle. He talks very openly about the fact that he doesn't believe in any of the political points of the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. He identifies as a libertarian, he says.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't believe in their any of their policies. And yet he put a Republican in the White House, and mm-hmm. he doesn't care.
And what does Stone get out of all of this?
I don't know. Do you think he just enjoys the power of disrupting the system? He just seems like a pure disruptor, doesn't he?
Absolutely. One thing I'll say, I suppose, in terms of his libertarian leanings, I think going back to Nixon, if you look at the 1960s at the time in rising struggles, particularly the civil rights movement, Nixon was the kind of block against that. It's why he's got so much respect for Nixon. I think he's very much...
He has a big tattoo of Nixon on his back.
Yes.
And he splashes that throughout the documentary.
He does, and I think going back to the question of racism, I think it's why it becomes such a key issue. Haldeman, who was the chief of staff under Nixon, wrote in one of his diaries, Nixon said, the problem was essentially the blacks. And what he meant by that was black struggle became the nexus for other social struggles. It was leading to concessions being won, social reforms on the system. So he knew that... drawing back the civil rights struggles and the black struggles was absolutely crucial. That's why I think racism has played such a key role in some of his tactics. As you said, he might not necessarily have massive racist leanings, but he knew it was essential to push forward this kind of libertarian model that he does agree with, which is a rolling back of state intervention.
He knew he had to play that racism card in order to win votes, essentially. And I want to actually ask you more about that a bit later on.
Now the children's table is the adult table, and Alex Jones is, you know, passing the dinner rolls, and we're all conspiracy American now.
Even if Donald Trump loses, I still win, because the Stone brand has been front and center, and my brand of politics have finally come into their own. CNN, MSNBC, they're now the fringe. Alt-right communications, we are the mainstream.
Did Trump really believe that Obama was not born in the United States? Does Roger Stone really believe that Bill Clinton raped all these women? You know, it doesn't matter to them is more the point. For them, there are no boundaries. Anything goes. Anything that wins, fine.
If you read Roger's blog, The Stone Zone, or follow him on Twitter, it's like coming attractions for the attacks Donald Trump will be launching 2 weeks later.
It is Hillary who hires the heavy-handed pride detectives who break into these women's homes and ransack them, who threaten their children, who kill their pets.
She's married to a man who was the worst abuser of women in the history of politics. And Hillary was an enabler, and she treated these women horribly.
Roger's
you know, relationship with Trump has been so interconnected that it's hard to define what's Roger and what's Donald. While it will be clearly a Trump presidency, I think it's influenced by a Stone philosophy.
That notion of win at any cost pretty much summarizes Stone's brand of politics. And there's so much to dissect from that clip. And Rich, if we look at the mainstream media angle, Roger Stone and Donald Trump were able to discredit the media, and the media became powerless against them. How were the campaign team able to do this, and why was this so effective?
I find it just shocking that they've been able to kind of marginalize all the mainstream and bring in people like Alex Jones and Breitbart as kind of the voice of this generation. I find it just horrifying that people are going there.
Alex Jones is, of course, a famous conspiracy theorist.
Insane conspiracy theorist, like far right wing, and really frightening. I mean, the clips that you see of him are pretty hilarious, actually, because he's just completely rabid and crazy.
But show me that would discredit
part of this,
Trump.
He's part of this, and it's this disruptive presence. It's trying to shake the system up and create a smaller government and let people do what they want. And it's not really the Republican agenda, but they're using the Republican Party to do it. And
yeah, that is a very interesting point. And yeah. Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this sort of fake news era that we're in and post-truth era.
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying, the clip with Roger Stone's where he said the NBC, the CNN, actually, they're marginalized now, the Breitbart, and the more alt-right communications. It might be a slight exaggeration, but are becoming the more mainstream news source. It's something the author Tariq Ali called about the extreme center. It's coming into the mainstream, which is very, very concerning, because this has a ripple effects, actually. It gives a confidence to the far right. Some of the appalling attacks we saw after the Trump presidency, because the platform given to the prominent far right blogs such as Breitbart is very concerning.
And how are left-wing groups trying to combat this?
I think what was very interesting over here, I know there's I forget the name of the blog in the States, but certainly over here you saw the election of Jeremy Corbyn, that social media was absolutely instrumental in that. The work of Momentum were combating the government's austerity agenda and helping to push some of Corbyn's policies forward, and it had a bigger impact in getting to young people in the general election.
So there's still some hope, I see. And I think, going back to the documentary, I think one of the funniest lines that Roger Stone says is that politics is show business for ugly people. But on a serious note, I mean, is this what politics has been reduced to now, Rich? I mean, is it merely a freak show, a circus, and not serving the best interests of the people anymore?
Well, you kind of hope that this will snap people out of it. It's like the fact that Donald Trump was elected president should make everybody stop and say, wait a minute, something's horribly wrong here. You know, the fact that Britain voted for Brexit made Britain stop. And then the next election, everybody kind of hesitated and thought, wait a minute. And the vote shifted quite dramatically because people spoke up and spoke the truth, which hadn't been spoken up during the campaign originally. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that that's what we see in America. I'm hoping that the people who just didn't speak up during the election last year will come out at the next one and kind of make the truth known and get because I think the truth has to win out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's too depressing to think that these people are going to win.
And I'd love to end it on that note, actually. Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Zach, for your time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The International Monetary Fund has warned the emergency support provided by central banks and finance ministries during the COVID-19 pandemic has fueled speculation and left the world vulnerable to another financial crisis. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Patricia Cohen and Alan Rappaport. The piece is titled "World's Growth Cools and the Rich-Poor Divide Widens." The article has been published by the New York Times. A closely watched report warned on Tuesday, 12th of October, as the world economy struggles to find its footing, the resurgence of the coronavirus and supply chain chokeholds threaten to hold back the global economic recovery's momentum. The International Monetary Fund said in its latest World Economic Outlook report, the overall growth rate will remain near 6% this year, a historically high level after a recession. But the expansion reflects a vast divergence in the fortunes of rich and poor countries. Worldwide poverty, hunger, and unmanageable debt are all under upswing. Employment has fallen, especially for women, reversing many of the gains they made in recent years. Uneven access to vaccines and healthcare is at the heart of the economic disparities. While booster vaccine shots are becoming available in some wealthier nations, a staggering 96% of people in low-income countries are still unvaccinated. Geeta Gopinath, the IMF's chief economist, wrote in the report, "Recent developments have made it abundantly clear that we're all in this together, and the pandemic is not over anywhere until it is over everywhere." The outlook for the United States, Europe, and other advanced economies has also darkened. Factories hobbled by pandemic-related restrictions and bottlenecks at key ports around the world have caused crippling supply shortages. A lack of workers in many industries is contributing to the clogs. The U.S. Labor Department reported on Tuesday, 12th of October, that a record 4.3 million workers quit their jobs in the month of August to take or seek new jobs or to leave the workforce altogether. In the United States, weakening consumption and large declines in inventory caused the International Monetary Fund to pare back its growth projections to 6% from earlier 7% estimates in July. In Germany, manufacturing output has taken a hit because key commodities are hard to find. and lockdown measures over the summer have dampened growth in Japan. Fear of rising inflation, even if likely to be temporary, is growing. Prices are climbing for food, medicines, and oil, as well as for cars and trucks. Inflation worries could also limit government's ability to stimulate the economy if a slowdown worsens. As it is, the unusual infusion of public support in the United States and Europe is winding down. Geeta Gopinath, the International Monetary Fund's chief economist, said, "Overall risks for economic prospects have increased and policy trade-offs have become more complex." The IMF lowered its 2021 global economic growth forecast to 5.9%, down from 6% projected in July. For 2022, the estimate is 4.9%. Gregory Dacko, chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics, said, "The key to understanding the global economy is that recoveries in different countries are out of sync." He said, "Each and every economy is suffering or benefiting from its own idiosyncratic factors." Gregory Dacko said for countries like China, Vietnam, and South Korea, whose economies have large manufacturing sectors, inflation hits them where it hurts the most, raising costs of raw materials that reverberate through the production process. The pandemic has underscored how economic success or failure in one country can ripple throughout the world. Floods in Shaanxi, China's mining region, and monsoons in India's coal-producing states contribute to rising energy prices worldwide. A COVID outbreak in Ho Chi Minh City that shuts factories means shop owners in Hoboken won't have shoes and sweaters to sell. National Monetary Fund warned that if the coronavirus or its variants continue to hopscotch across the globe, it could reduce the world's estimated output by as much as $5.3 trillion over the next 5 years. The worldwide surge in energy prices threatens to impose more hardship as it hampers the economic recovery. Recently, oil prices hit a 7-year high in the United States. With winter approaching, Europeans are worried that heating costs will soar when temperatures drop. In other spots, the shortages have cut even deeper, causing blackouts in some places that paralyze transport, closing down factories and threatening food supplies. In some Southeast Asian countries, electricity is being rationed in many provinces and many companies are operating at less than half of their capacity, contributing to an already significant slowdown in economic growth. India's coal reserves have dropped to dangerously low levels. And over the weekend, Lebanon's 6 million residents were left without any electricity for more than 24 hours after fuel shortages shut down the nation's power plants. The power outage is just the latest in a series of disasters created by the United States and its Western allies there. Its economic and financial crisis has been one of the world's worst in the past 150 years. Oil producers in West Asia and elsewhere are lately benefiting from the jump in oil prices, but many nations in the region and North Africa are still trying to resuscitate their pandemic-battered economies. According to newly updated reports from the World Bank, 13 of the 16 countries in that region will have lower standards of living this year than they did before the pandemic, in large part because of the underfinanced, imbalanced, and ill-prepared healthcare systems. Other countries were so overburdened by debt even before the pandemic that governments were forced to limit spending on healthcare to repay foreign lenders. In Latin America and the Caribbean, there are fears of a second lost decade of growth like the one experienced after 2010. In South Africa, over one-third of the population is out of work. And in East Asia and the Pacific, a World Bank update